Hot days, short runways. Why would you guess when there's a way you can know for sure? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. We like to get together on Mondays and talk about safety issues. Bob, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
Well, Paul, as always, I enjoy being with you.
You are about, we're about to get into a conversation here, Bob, about something that I have learned a lot about in the last year and a half after moving from the Portland, Oregon area, where most of the airports were at somewhere around 200 feet MSL, to the Salt Lake City area, where they're all between 4,000 and 5,000 MSL. And aircraft do behave differently, and we kind of have to know what to expect from our aircraft when we move into those environments.
Indeed they do, Paul. And how is it we pilots, compensate for that? What information must we access in order to determine just what impact those various elevations will have on our airplane and how long it will take to get off, for example?
Well, I think the big one is called density altitude.
Density altitude, sure. And that information, you query the average pilot today out on the ramp, and of course this is something that we don't go around doing, but for our listeners, a definition of density altitude is what? What is density altitude, and how is it different from other kinds of altitude, like pressure altitude or true altitude or absolute altitude? Density altitude is ultimately the altitude that the airplane thinks it's at when it starts marching down the runway.
Well, if you want to get a quick fix on density altitude, can you not just sitting on the runway, say you're at a little uncontrolled airport out in the middle of nowhere, and there are some in my part of the country that answer to that description, dial in 2992 in the Colesman and see what it says?
Well, that will give you what, Paul? That'll give you pressure altitude.
Right.
And now we have a pressure altitude, and then we have something that is the real key to all of this, is that what's the temperature outside?
Mm-hmm.
So density altitude, as many of our listeners know, is simply pressure altitude corrected for non-standard temperature. We had a case that I reported in Over the Airwaves of a Cherokee 180 taking off from an airport in Springerville, Arizona, and on a otherwise long runway, an 8,000 foot runway, he and a friend and some baggage, a couple of cases of beer, I think is what the NTSB report said, could not successfully get off an 8,000 foot runway. And, one would say, well, 7,000 feet, a Cherokee ought to be able to do that. But when they factored in the temperature that particular day, the computed density altitude was 9,476 feet. The poor soul didn't survive the takeoff. In fact, the first effort was downwind because it was a quartering wind across the runway, and whether or not he misjudged which direction it was going, but tried it in one direction, was not successful, came back and took off in the opposite direction, and witnesses said the airplane labored and porpoised, and finally it crashed at the end of the runway. And NTSB called it the pilot's failure to attain and maintain an adequate airspeed during takeoff in high-density altitude conditions, which resulted in an aerodynamic stall. This could have been predicted. The laws of physics are immutable, particularly when it comes to airplanes. If the airplane has a service ceiling of 10,000 feet and you're taking off on a 9,000-foot day, you can't expect much from that little airplane.
Well, now, Bob, the report also mentions that he, when he didn't get off the runway the first time, he went back and said something to someone who later became a witness in the accident report about checking because he suspected that he had a low tire. If your aircraft is performing like it has a flat tire and you go and check and the tires are fine, man, how does it not occur to you that something's terribly wrong?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we don't know, of course, what was going through the mind of the pilot. But he, the report also indicated that he was loading on, cases of, in this case, beer, but it could have been water or Pepsi Cola. It makes no difference. There's added weight, with another passenger. On a 9,000 foot density altitude day, this is something that, that airplane, even light with half fuel, just one pilot may not have made it off. We have a responsibility as pilots to get into those performance tables. Now, that's something that seems rather obvious. But how about just taking off on a normal, what we call lowland airport, like you, as you had in Portland, but it's a short runway. Let's suppose it's a 1,800-foot runway, and it's a hot day in Portland, and we're taking off in that same Piper 180. Can we get off in 1,800 feet with obstacles at the other end, or do we leave it to chance? You know, these numbers have been carefully developed by the engineers who test flew that airplane way back when, and something that unfortunately a lot of accidents result from somebody taking off and exceeding or attempting to exceed the performance capabilities of that little airplane.
Well, and there are a couple of airports in the Portland area, or in Oregon anyway, where even on a day when density altitude was not a factor, you might be accustomed to knowing that your 150 can get off the ground in, you know, 400 feet or 500 feet at a particular temperature. But then all of a sudden you find yourself in an airport that's surrounded by 120-foot pine trees. And, you know, you may not ever have looked at what it takes to clear a 50-foot obstacle or interpolated what it means then to clear a 100-foot obstacle.
Yep, that's exactly right. And then there's another factor, too. Let's just suppose that we're taking off on a high-density altitude day from our home airport with obstacles, but this is the first time we've taken off on a 95-degree day. And so the airplane isn't performing the way we expect it to perform, and it's spending more time on the runway than we thought. Rather than using proper short field technique, we attempt to mush the airplane off by pulling back on the yoke in a vain effort to get the airplane up sooner, faster, and all it's doing is mushing up when we in fact should be keeping the nose down, building airspeed, and again using proper short field technique to get off. In other words, the airplane is handling so much differently than we're used to. We then apply improper technique to solve the problem, and that's another problem.
Well, Bob, when we come back from the break, let's talk briefly about some of the other things in the performance tables that maybe we should look at more often. Bob Miller is my guest. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3320.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, talking about performance tables and how important it is to know what's in them and use them. Bob, we've talked about a little bit about weight and balance. We've talked a little bit about density altitude and its effect on takeoff distance and all that sort of thing. There are a few other things in the manual that come to mind that we need to know about. One of them that I have seen in some of the training aircraft I've flown in the pilot operating handbook is actual details on the difference it makes whether you're taking off with a slight headwind or a slight tailwind.
Major difference. Major difference. That's perhaps the biggest difference other than density altitude is which way are the winds blowing. You think of taking off in no wind or a slight headwind. And you'll see a slight difference. Try taking off with a slight tailwind, and it is a huge difference for some rules of physics that I'm not sure I fully comprehend. But we know that a 5-knot, 10-knot tailwind can extend the takeoff length, takeoff roll tremendously. But we don't have to guess that, Paul, because it's in the performance tables. Most performance tables, performance tables today in most aircraft, certainly in all recently constructed aircraft, are giving us this information.
Do we get, Bob, complacent on this partly because, I mean, never look in the book, partly because we're used to flying our small general aviation aircraft off runways that can handle a 747?
Yep. And that's the problem with big, you know, schools that teach on big airports. You know, when we're taking off an 8,000-foot airliner type airport, you know, we really don't think about short field technique for what it really means unless we go out on that 1,500-foot or 1,800-foot airport. And oftentimes those 1,500, 1,800-foot airports are also grass-covered or turf-covered. And so this is one of the pet peeves that I have. Everybody needs to get out on the grass. Unfortunately, a number of flight schools, they make up reasons for not doing that. They say it's against insurance regulations. I have yet to find an insurance policy that prohibits an aircraft from going off, taking off on grass. But that's a frequently given excuse, given to pilots, student pilots. We can't do that. We've got to get out there and do it for real. Do it on real short airports. Now, I don't mean careless and reckless. Crank the numbers. We go into the performance tables. We know what the winds are. We know what the runway conditions are. We know the density altitude, and we ought to be able to figure out what our total ground roll and takeoff length should be, certainly within 100 feet or so, and then put those rules to work.
All right, Bob, I want to talk about one more thing in closing here. During the break, you mentioned Randy Babbitt's comments at the Bombardier safety stand down and the question he posed to the audience, do you fly with precision? What does that mean to you? What did it mean in his context, and how do we apply that in GA?
That's a very good question, and he posed a very good question. Do you fly with precision when we talk about a commitment to professionalism? Now, Randy Babbitt's talking to professional pilots for the most part, but he's also referring or perhaps inferring that a lot of us are not flying with precision. We get in the airplane, we advance the throttles, we hold it on the ground until it feels right, then we give it a little tug on the yoke. And we glide off into Never Never Land. How many of us are actually flying with the precision to know precisely what VR is, what rotation speed is? What speed, what is VX speed? What is VY speed? What speed should we have in the climb? What speed should we have when we're over the numbers prior to landing? This is, to me, flying with precision. Knowing precisely what that airplane is doing, knowing the numbers, not only knowing the numbers, I mean memorizing these performance numbers. This is something that we can easily get away from. And, I, as a flight instructor, can be first to admit my own guilt in this regard simply because we fly in different airplanes. Unlike an airline pilot who, for the most part, is flying same make and model for a period of months, maybe years, we flight instructors are getting in, a J3 Cub, then we get in a 172, then we get in a Cessna Corvallis, Cirrus SR-22. These numbers are all grossly different. Do we have, is it our responsibility to know what those numbers are prior to instructing in those airplanes? Yep. I learned this the hard way, and I reported on this a month or so ago by my experience giving a flight review in an experimental aircraft that, frankly, I did not know the numbers as well as I should have, and it came back to bite us. So flying with precision means know what those performance numbers are before you get into any airplane that you're responsible for.
Well, you talk about the flight training environment, especially in the Part 61 universe, where you might be in and out of a bunch of planes, or whether you're giving flight reviews where you're in and out of a lot of customer planes. I remember at one flight school where I used to rent aircraft, just the difference between the old 150, the new 150, and the 152 were markedly different in some of these areas.
Yeah, it's a huge responsibility that we have. I know I've got a good friend who flies 747s for now Delta Airlines, used to be Northwest Airlines, but he's a flight instructor, and he was always ragging on the fact that at 1,000 feet on the final approach to landing at 1,000 feet. Company policy was if you were not on your numbers at 1,000 feet AGL, you had to go around. And I mean, that's right on your speeds, right on your altitude. If you weren't there, go around. And if we private pilots practice that same kind of thinking, if we're not on our numbers at 1,000 feet AGL on coming in for landing, then it's time to think about a go around.
Well, Bob, as always, thought-provoking stuff, trying to raise the bar here, and we'll refer our listeners to the newsletter for more and talk to you again next Monday.
Thanks, Paul.
You can find the latest edition of Bob's newsletter at overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.